You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd Kenter Thomas & Parrish, LLC, and American Federation of Teachers of Kansas. Since 1983, our attorneys have aggressively represented the injured and have provided counseling to labor organizations throughout the area. We stand for working families against those who would do harm, and that's Boyd Kenter Thomas & Parrish. Then AFT Kansas is teachers, nurses, and healthcare professionals, and workers in our universities, cities, counties, and state. Our mission is to be good partners in building thriving communities by reclaiming the promise of strong public schools, of quality public services, and of healthcare institutions that put patients before profits. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we dig deeper into the pipeline debate with Laborers International Rep Kevin Pranis about the need to repair leaky pipes and stiffen regulations. Then, women rising up to put hatred and oppression down. We'll hear from women at the Washington, D.C. March on January 21st and find out how many people turned out in KC and why they came. In the news, lots of juicy issues in support for the UAW Challenge Strikers and PUSDR down. Score one for our side. Now for the news.
This is the news from our side. Many organizations on the side of workers are claiming victory in the withdrawal of CKE restaurants. CEO Andy Putzer nomination as labor secretary. Here in Kansas City, the demonstrations against PUSDR were organized by Stand Up KC, and today they organized a celebration at Hardee's Restaurant on Independence. When Trump first nominated the fast food CEO last year, many interpreted the action as a direct slap in the face of the fight for 15 and a union. Then the revelations started coming from Hardee's and Carl Jr.'s employees about life under PUSDR management, rampant wage theft and violations of wage and hour laws that PUSDR would have been in charge of enforcing as Secretary of Labor. Then came the ads he sponsored with semi-nude women posing with dripping hamburgers, followed by dozens of allegations of sexual harassment on the job. But it was the admission that he hired an undocumented immigrant to clean his house and he abused a former wife that finally got to enough Republicans in the Senate to sink his nomination. Sexual harassment and wage theft evidently weren't sufficient to nail him. Obviously, the Senate majority cares more about not giving a job to a maid. Go figure. The campaign against PUSDR was broad among progressive organizations and included Jobs with Justice and the National Employment Law Project. Now all are waiting to find out who Trump will appoint next to ensure that our workplaces are safe and the workers are not subject to sweatshop conditions.
The strike at Challenge, an auto parts manufacturer near the airport, is heading into its third week. Workers walked out Thursday, February 2nd in a dispute over promises of raises that weren't fulfilled, wage theft, and discriminatory treatment of Muslim employees and women. One worker reported five Muslim employees were denied time to pray during their shift and were fired. 45% of the workers at Challenge are refugees or on work visas. They come from Cuba, Kenya, Somalia, Mexico, Sudan, and Ethiopia. Support for the union from these new Americans appears to be strong. 85% of the workers walked out. The company is hiring scabs. One worker told News from Our Side volunteer Ariana Eckel, "This company treats us like trash. We're not going to take it anymore." Challenge makes welded assemblies and other engineering metal products for the General Motors Fairfax assembly plant. A worker told Fox 4 that they were getting paid less than their counterparts in St. Louis and Texas. According to the worker, the other plants have just agreed to a new contract and are making $15 an hour, while workers in North Kansas City are making anywhere from $12 to $14. The workers are represented by United Auto Workers Local 710. Rick Klingenberg, president of Local 710, told Ariana that the workers want parity with challenge plants in St. Louis and Texas. But they had underbid work here. The company had underbid work here, pushed out another supplier where workers lost their jobs, and now are refusing to negotiate fair terms. Challenge brags on its webpage that it's an employee-owned company. It says it employs approximately 3,000 team members supported by 1,000 industrial robots. Really, what is it? What it is an ESOP, or an employee stock ownership plan, which is a kind of tax dodge that rarely gives the workers, either team members or robots, a say in how the company is run. That's not the only tax dodge Champion has. Almost a year and a half ago, the city of Kansas City recommended authorization of up to $56 million in taxable industrial revenue bonds for the automotive parts supplier to locate a new operation in an existing building on Kansas City International Airport property, purchase the machinery for it, and expand the facility up to 423,000 square feet. The city also gave Challenge a personal property tax abatement for 10 years at 75% of all property purchased within the first 10 years. City Hall staff estimated that that abatement would be valued at nearly $5 million over 10 years. The city would also pay Challenge's property taxes through a 25% payment in lieu of taxes. It was estimated at the time that the Park Hill School District would lose $3.56 million in tax revenue because of the deal.
Workers at Boeing's aircraft plant in South Carolina voted resoundingly not to be represented by the International Association of Machinists on Wednesday, ending a multi-year campaign. In These Times saw it coming. They reported that anti-union sentiment runs high in South Carolina, where union membership is just 1.6%, the lowest in the nation. South Carolina is also a so-called right-to-work state. Boeing has 3,000 workers there. There had been an earlier attempt to have a union vote in 2015, but the IAM canceled it, citing an atmosphere of threats, harassment, and unprecedented political interference. Since a new election was scheduled last month, Boeing workers who spoke to In These Times said that Boeing has been unrelenting in its opposition to the union. Randy Toller, a worker, said, "It's just a constant barrage. Any opportunity they've had, they've hit us with an anti-union message." Elliot Slater, another worker, said, "A normal day consists of, well, you go to work, you hear something anti-union at your morning meeting, there will be some literature handed out so we can take your breaks in the break area, they've got the TVs running and they play anti-union commercials throughout the day. And then you top that off when you get home, you've got the anti-union commercials, radio and TV, and then you check your mailbox and you've got anti-union literature in your mailbox." Mike Evans, the lead organizer on the campaign, says Boeing has a strategy of spreading what is now called alternative facts, that is, lies and whisper campaigns. He said the union has to waste a lot of time correcting the facts. There were also very public anti-union statements made by local and state politicians. The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Judy Ansel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Solidarity for My name is Lon Swearingen. On tonight's Heartland Labor Forum, we will be talking with Kevin Prince, an organizer for the Labor International Union of North America. Maybe you listened to the program a few months ago when Kevin and I were talking about the Dakota Pipeline Project. At that time, it was brought up that there were plenty of pipelines that were weaker than the newest pipelines. So the discussion will be somewhat about fixing those pipelines, but more than anything, understanding LUNA and what they're really about. Kevin, give us some information about yourself, and then, if you would, give us a brief history of the Labor International Union of North America, including what kind of projects other than pipelines that the union works on.
Sure. My name is Kevin Prentiss. I'm the marketing manager, which for us means that I run the organizing program for LIUNA in Minnesota and North Dakota. Been with this union for, I guess, about 7 years, and was with the Change to Win Labor Federation before that, and have a couple decades of experience in various community and labor organizing efforts. Our membership is largely construction workers and the number of public employees in the U.S. and Canada. Minnesota, we've got about 12,000 members across Minnesota and North Dakota, primarily in construction and a number in the public sector.
And then how many pipelines has the union been involved with?
Well, pipelines are a core industry for us. We've been involved extensively for, more than 50 years in building pipelines. We do the bulk of the labor work on a pipeline along with other construction crafts. And so pipeline work is certainly an important area for us, and that's not only the construction of new pipelines, it's also building the distribution lines that bring, for example, natural gas to people's houses, buildings so they can heat their homes, cook, et cetera. So it's a pretty extensive infrastructure, and it's just one piece of what we do. We're active in water infrastructure, underground utilities, underground communications, fiber optic, building streets, we build buildings. So our members do a wide range of work, from removal of asbestos to building water and sewer systems to helping build skyscrapers.
Is there a program to upgrade and or fix problems with pipelines?
Yeah, so there are a set of federal regulations primarily, as well as state regulations that govern the operation and maintenance of pipelines. And you have each pipeline owner is undertaking regular inspections of their pipelines, maintenance work, and in some cases, replacement. I won't say that every owner does it equally well. There are certainly companies that we primarily work with that put a lot of effort and money into investigating their own pipelines, monitoring them, making sure that they're in proper condition, identifying problems long before they result in problem impacts, and trying to get those problems addressed. And so we have thousands of members on a daily basis across the country involved in dig-ups where you're exposing existing lines, checking to see what the inline tools that were sent through the line might have detected for anomalies, determining what needs to be done in that case, whether it's just a matter of recoating a pipe or whether sections of pipe have to be completely replaced. So it's a major part of our work. In fact, we probably get as much or more work from the maintenance of existing pipelines in Minnesota as we do from the construction of new pipelines.
Okay. Are there regulations to deal with problems of fixing and upgrading pipelines that the government has? And do you explain how that works?
Yeah, there are specific regulations that are promulgated by the Pipeline Hazardous Safety Management Material Agency. It's PHMSA. I always get the acronym wrong. So they're part of the Department of Transportation. They have pipeline inspectors who go out They'll do sometimes physical reviews, but most importantly, they're reviewing the procedures that companies have. They're reviewing their paperwork. Pipeline operators are not undertaking the proper maintenance, don't have the proper systems in place, don't have the proper response plans, they issue citations, force them to improve their operations. And so that's the federal oversight of this. And then you have standards that are promulgated by the federal government, as well as standards that are promulgated by the industry through the American Petroleum Institute, that has been working on getting an upgraded set of industry standards that should govern construction and maintenance of pipelines. And that's been an undertaking of many years to try to upgrade the standards we're using for pipeline. Certainly a lot's been learned over the past several decades about what it takes to make a pipeline safe, much has been learned about what it takes to keep airplanes safe, or cars, or many other things that we live with in our daily lives.
So with that, then, the pipelines, they tell us, are safer than doing it by train or trucks. Is that correct?
Yes.
And why is that?
Well, pipelines are designed, if you think about it this way, that pipelines are designed to move gas and oil. So first of all, there's all sorts of features in place and pipelines that are not going to be in place with a rail system, which is designed to move any number of things, or with a network of roads. Trucking is a tremendously inefficient way. It's necessary for the last few miles often, whether it's from a well site or the last few miles of delivery, some places where the pipelines can't reach. But you're really depending primarily on pipeline with a certain amount of rail. And the problem with rail is that our rail lines simply aren't in good enough shape that you can guarantee that trains will always stay on the tracks, which is what you want to be shooting for. Pipelines are also, fortunately, underground, so they're less affected by weather conditions that can affect rail traffic. You don't have the on-grade, at-grade crossings. You have many thousands of crossings where the road and the train and the rail tracks are on the same level. So you have the potential for cars, for example, to be on train tracks, people to be, various things to be on the tracks instead of being separated. So you're a lot safer putting that pipeline underground in a pipeline that's been specifically designed to move oil or to move natural gas than in a rail car. Rail car is really just designed to serve where there's insufficient pipeline capacity or where there's a temporary need.
Now, you have done, they are going to do the Dakota pipeline project. Now, you said something to the effect that you were putting it under 90 feet under the ground, under the water. Is there a way to protect that? In other words, are there valves that can lock out if it starts to have a leak somewhere?
Yep, there's so you have monitoring technologies there. You have block valves that are used to, particularly on either side. Likely the pipe that's under the river would be some of the least risk because it's so far, you're talking about so far into the soils and often to bedrock underneath bodies of water, that's actually your least risk. It's the pipeline that's closer to the surface that you need to watch, and that's where the block valves have the capacity to shut that off. They also use a stronger, thicker wall pipe for the underground to make sure that you have something that can stand up to the pressures under there, and that's sufficiently strong to prevent any possible leak. So there's a number of different features that are used to try to make those pipelines safe and those water crossings. And they are, I think you'll see a much, much better result out of the directionally drilled pipes that are going underwater crossings than what used to be done, which is simply basically digging a ditch into the lake or riverbed and laying the pipeline on the bottom, or in some cases literally just laying the pipeline on the lake or riverbed, which is not something that's practiced anymore because of the risks to corrosion of those lines and exposure to damage.
Is there a way that they lock them if there's a leak starting? Is there a way that it can turn off?
Yeah, there's automatic, so there's valves that can be controlled remotely. So you have constant monitoring of a number of different variables, in terms of pressures, flows, that's looking to detect any possible changes, right? Basically, they're looking for any changes in pressures and flows that can't be explained by what's being done deliberately in terms of the movement of oil. And so whenever there's any kind of, that'll send out an alert, and then it'll be the responsibility of the company to do the further investigation to determine, is this a false alarm? Is there, an anomaly that needs to get fixed that isn't leaking yet? Is there or is there potentially a leak? And it basically, as soon as a leak is discovered, you use these remote systems to shut the valves off. So that can be done before a person would actually be able to get to the location to operate manual valves.
Okay, that sounds very good on that level. How about the lines that were put in years ago? Are they being redone, or are they just stopping them altogether? How do they work that?
So that's a challenge, and it's similar to the challenge that we face in other areas of infrastructure. We have aging bridges. We have aging highways, in some cases, that need to be updated. Sometimes you have an asset that has outlived its useful life or is getting close to outliving its useful life that really needs to be replaced, that can no longer be patched up. And so, for example, in Minnesota, there's the Line 3 pipeline that's nearing the end of its useful life. It was built using construction techniques and technologies that are no longer used, that are outdated, that make it particularly vulnerable to some of the challenges in terms of integrity that have to be managed on a daily basis by the company. And so the plan in Minnesota that's being proposed is to replace that with a new and modern pipeline that would be able to operate safely at full capacity with, for many decades to come, since that's the, this is a part of a pipeline network that supplies the vast majority of all the gasoline and fuel that we use in Minnesota. So it would be a huge impact if that line were to not to be able to operate because of integrity problems. And we have members who are working every year. Dozens of members are working on that pipeline doing patching up integrity work to keep it operating safely. Even so, they can only operate it at a little above half capacity in order to prevent growth of stress cracks and problems that you could, if they were allowed, left unchecked, cause an environmental or a outage problem.
Well, thank you. You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, and I'm talking with Kevin Prince of the Labor's International Union of North America, which is involved with pipelines as well as other construction projects. And again, what other projects is the union working on now, and what are some of them that you're union is doing now, other than pipelines?
So we build, we participate in the building of pretty much everything. So in Minnesota, we recently completed the Vikings football stadium, which is a big one. We've built light rail projects, which have a significant positive impact on the climate in terms of reducing the need for use of cars. We think that building that, we're building solar and wind installations in Minnesota and in North Dakota. Again, technologies that have real potential to make a positive impact on climate. We're also active in a wide range of building construction. We're seeing the biggest boom in school construction that we've probably ever seen in the state. Right now, lots of local school districts have been raising money from taxpayers to add facilities, expand, accommodate growth, replace some of their aging infrastructure. Our members are very active not only in building those schools, but also in helping support referenda within their own school districts where they live, because they recognize how important quality facilities are for having a good learning environment and a successful school system. So, it's a wide range of construction work that our members do, pretty much anything you could think of.
And so that your major projects have been basically pipelines, is that right, or am I reading that wrong?
No, pipelines are, they're just one. Again, our members work across all sorts of industries, so we've got members doing highway work, water, sewer, other underground utilities. We're building energy and maintaining energy installations ranging from coal to natural gas to wind to solar. We're also active in, you know, building construction, everything from gas stations, you know, up to, you know, multi-story towers, skyscrapers. Our members are really active in an incredibly diverse number of building, and that there's not one place where we could say this is where most of the jobs come from. The jobs really come from all over. And our members have a very diverse range of opportunities. You know, they might specialize in one area. They may work across multiple areas. They might be working on a school, and then their next project, they could be working on a pipeline. It just depends.
So do you do highways and those kinds of things also?
Yep, we do highways, and we're also very active, not only, again, in construction, but around advocacy for the necessary funding for maintaining highway road infrastructure, which is also critical to our daily lives. And it's a concern for us, not only because we build them, but also because our members have longer commutes typically than almost any other type of worker, aside from truck drivers. Our members have to drive all over the place to get to their construction projects. And so, you know, we have to deal with the problems with aging infrastructure firsthand.
So how people have talked about bridges that are not being repaired and all this. How does the union help push that kind of thing? In other words, helping us understand things. In other words, what I'm going to say is, how can unions help non-union members understand that unions are necessary in a global corporate economy to make sure that there is fairness for the worker?
Well, I think that's a good question. I mean, there's a lot we do that helps all construction workers, whether they're union or not. Whether we're doing a great job of explaining that, you know, even fully to our own members, that's a good question and something we need to do a better job on. But just to provide some examples, we've been very active in pushing for transportation funding. So here in Minnesota, we're very aware of the dangers of having infrastructure that's not, you know, where it needs to be. We had the pretty famous 35W freeway bridge collapse happen here, which was a terrible accident. That bridge was repaired in record time. It was an unbelievable project involving lots of skilled manpower that, you know, I don't think people outside would have believed could get done in the short time that it was to rebuild that bridge. But, you know, that was a pretty devastating and woke a lot of people up about the dangers of allowing the infrastructure to deteriorate and the dangers of, you know, having infrastructure that wasn't necessarily built the way it needed to be in the first place.
I've been talking with Kevin Pant of the Laborers International Union of North America on the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Lon Swergen. Kevin, thanks a lot, and I appreciate what you've said because I want that out. It's important.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Have you ever thought about the artistry behind the artist? Kansas City photographer E.G. Schempf is our guest on the next Anything Goes show with Charles Ferrugia. I'm show producer Martha Lally. Tune in to learn the finer points of accurately documenting an artist's work through photography. That's next time on the Anything Goes show, Friday at noon.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sophie Cruz. We are here together making a chain of love to protect our families. Let us fight with love, faith, and courage so that our families will not be destroyed. I also want to tell the children not to be afraid because we are not alone. There are still many people that have their hearts filled with love and tenders to snuggle in this path of life. Let's keep together and fight for the rights. God is with us.
Know your place. Shut up and smile. Don't speak.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. You've just listened to Sophie Cruz at the Women's March 2017 in Washington, D.C. Sophie Cruz is a 7-year-old American activist. Her parents are undocumented immigrants from the state of Oaxaca in Mexico. Her fears that her parents could face deportation have made her one of the youngest voices in the American immigration reform movement. We've also just listened to the song I Won't Keep Quiet by Milk. Women who came together in Washington, D.C., January 21st. That is our topic tonight, women in protest, rising up to put hate and oppression down. We will discuss the mighty demonstration that took place in Washington, D.C. on January 21st, the day following President Trump's inauguration. My name is Chris Mann, and I'll be the host for this evening's program. Our guest tonight helped 600 Missourians travel to D.C. Britton Bollenbach and Katie Hilt are here to tell us about their organizing efforts, what the march accomplished, and what lessons we can draw from the experience for our future. Here in K.C., 10,000 women and men came to the park across from Union Station. Over 2 million women participated in the marches around the world and in D.C. Welcome, Britton and Katie.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Okay. I have to say, too, Britton was one of the founders of the effort in Missouri to start getting people to the Women's March.
Correct.
So, yes, mm-hmm. So we're really glad of your efforts. Mm-hmm. So let's get right to this wonderful event. Why did both of you decide to go to the march? And more over and above that, why did you decide to help other people go?
Right after the election, I was completely devastated. I never felt that much devastation before. I've had a lot of things happen in my life. I've worked overseas as an HIV/AIDS activist, as a counselor. I've worked in schools. I've worked with people. I've seen death. I've seen many things. And through all of that, I've loved my country very much. And when this election took place, my heart broke, completely shattered. I'm not a crier, and for 2 days, I cried. And that is not right. There was obviously something not just upsetting to me, something was devastating in me. and I needed to do something. And I knew I wasn't alone. And I needed to make sure that other people, especially in the Kansas City area, the red state areas, knew that they were not alone, that this devastation was real, and we weren't whining. We were talking about the integrity of our republic. And that's what got me going towards doing something and not just sitting around being devastated.
Yeah, I mean, to mirror that, I was devastated. I was above and beyond that. I'm a very big Hillary supporter for 25 years. So not only was that devastating, but it also hurt in a way of people. I felt like people said that what was represented by Trump and that campaign and what had been going on was okay. And that was devastating because I didn't feel like that represented what I believed America was or who we were. And it was not okay. And I also cried, like full snot cried for days.
Couldn't open your eyes. Couldn't. So swollen. Yes.
Yeah, going through tissues like crazy. I have a 3-year-old son, and I just thought, you know, part of my devastation was what do I say? I mean, he's only 3, but this is going to be what he sees for the next 4 years. If we're lucky, it's only 4 years. And that's, you know, where you teach them kindness and humility and that people aren't bad or different and that we all coexist together and everybody's great. And I felt like it made it harder to do that. So I was moved that way.
Yeah, and I have to say here, neither of you had any experience putting people on buses or organizing them. How was that for you for the first time? And we are so far apart, away from D.C.
Mm-hmm.
How did you convince people to go? Was it hard?
It was not a struggle. Was it a struggle?
It wasn't a struggle at all. At the beginning, it was a matter of just getting the word out. And once we were able to get the word out, then people were contacting us. The buses, people need to understand, we're not a big sorority of all of our friends. Mm-hmm. These are people that people didn't know. Yeah. Occasionally there would be someone that you would know.
Bring
that,
a friend.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Katie and I didn't know each other.
Nope. Not even a little.
Not even a little bit. We actually knew each other probably for a good month and a half just via texting.
Mm-hmm.
And so right after the election, we got the buses going. Well, I basically called up the bus companies after someone dropped out and said, okay, here's my money. So I invested my money into reserving the buses. And from that point on, just started putting out on social media, let's get more people in.
Yeah.
And the demand started to get a little bit more. It waned at some point mid-December.
Mm-hmm.
And then as more news came out.
Mm-hmm.
Once the 21st was coming closer, once January was coming closer, once people started to hear about it, people wanted to know more about it. And let me just say, the red states were probably more clamoring to go to D.C. than the blue states were. L.A. ended up having, I want to say, 1.5 million people in L.A. protesting, which was amazing. In New York and other blue states were able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Red states, it was great that we had such a great turnout in Kansas City and St. Louis and in Topeka. But I think so many people here wanted to get to D.C. and to represent and say, we do not stand for hate.
Mm-hmm.
We are strong. We're articulate. We love our simple lives to a certain extent. But what was said and what was demonstrated during the campaign and what's being demonstrated now kind of proves us right that this is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting people up there was just a matter of how much can we handle on one plate. And as you said, I began the grassroots part of it in Kansas City. And then finally, Missouri set up with its chapter, and so I'm a co-administrator for the Women's March, the national for the Missouri chapter. Mm-hmm. And then we all coordinate together to get everybody up. So it was a huge, huge thing that we all joined together to get done. But Kansas City can be proud that there were 3 grassroots. 2 of the buses were mine. There was a 3rd bus that was a grassroots as well. So we're good at being grassroots here.
Right. And you organized vans. I mean, you did so much more.
Yeah, got a couple vans and a few cars.
Mm-hmm. And at what point in this organizing part did you know it was going to be huge, or did you? Did you expect I felt that like in D.C.?
She felt more of it happening.
I felt like it was going to be
Yeah, Katie felt more
big
of it.
Pretty quickly. I mean, once that initial kind of fire started where the march kind of was gaining a little traction, I mean, that was early December, really. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was going to be big. And when people were trying to lowball that they didn't really think 200,000 people were going to make it in D.C., I kind of felt the opposite, that we were going to way overcompensate and that we would hit half a million.
I thought 200,000. I thought we would be about 200,000. And then we were pushing to get people to sign up to let us know. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, okay, maybe 300,000. Then we got there.
And then so that's a great point to lead into our next question. Describe what you saw when you got there.
People. Tons and tons and tons of people.
And
pink
and
hats
signs.
And people and signs. I mean, it was, and every type of person was not relegated to just women. I mean, all groups were represented, and they were represented very well.
It was a good demographic, too, mm-hmm. with the percentages. It didn't look like Congress. Mm-hmm. It looked like
it did not look like Congress.
It looked like the actual percentages that is represented in this country.
In the world.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Except for there were more women. We're about 51% here, but we were, of course, more of a majority there.
Mm-hmm.
But just the percentages kind of really related, like 13% about African-American and 17% about Hispanic, a little bit in there, a little, you know, and just – it really represented what the United States looks like more than that of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And that was beautiful. And
yes.
When we were walking, any time we came up against a police officer, they hugged us.
So nice.
So amazing to us. Mm-hmm. When we would go into the Smithsonian after the march, when we were like putting like sardines, when we got to escape.
Right, and go to the Natural History Museum.
The people who worked there stopped us in tears, shaking our hands.
Mm-hmm.
When we were our pussycat hats, they knew who we were. Mm-hmm. They would shake our hands, say, thank you for coming here and showing that our country is not hateful.
Right.
It was beautiful.
They were like, we got this. We're with you in this fight. Mm-hmm. We're here to help, and thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for coming.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and there were signs in yards. There were signs in yards. You need water. You need food. You mm-hmm. need a place to stay. Mm-hmm. People were stopping us, honking at us, going, way to go, pussycat hats. Way to go, women. And just mm-hmm. people. And at first, you know, as a woman, you're like defensive. And then all of a sudden, oh, my goodness, they're saying something nice.
Right.
oh, wow. Thanks. Thumbs up. Yay. We love you. Okay, thank you. I mean, let's just say it. I mean, we're used to, like, getting all bristled up. We mm-hmm. didn't have to get bristled up. They were actually
supportive.
Everybody had our backs.
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
So who were some of the speakers there at the National March?
Well, I heard Ashley Judd. That was the only person that actually took a microphone, thankfully, mm-hmm. and actually spoke into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know of some people there.
Michael Moore, I thought, was pretty amazing.
I didn't hear
Ashley Judd was amazing. Mm-hmm. Sophie, who you played
Gaga.
That clip, mm-hmm. she was adorable. I mean, mm-hmm. powerful for a little girl. I mean, it was mm-hmm. impressive.
And then there was Gloria Steinem, mm-hmm. and
I thought
like that. I wish I would have been able to hear Gloria Steinem. The thing mm-hmm. is, a lot of us in the crowd, a lot of us that came, what you guys got to see at home on your televisions, we didn't get to see.
No,
we were so crowded in there. We didn't hit each other. We were peaceful. Everything, but we were sardines. You could not move. And
you
inch.
Became very friendly with whoever you were touching.
There was a little bum in front of you. I'm sorry, but I'm gonna touch it.
Yeah,
it's there. Sorry.
You couldn't. You were very friendly.
And,
yes.
And that's just. And so we didn't necessarily.
Consensually.
And it was consensual. We just didn't know who exactly was up there. Like, people would say, this person's talking. We're like, fabulous.
Yay.
Don't drink water. Don't drink water. Don't go pee. Don't go pee.
Right. Because you'll never get back. We'll never find you.
Yes. And because I was one of the co-eds, I knew what the lineup kind of was. Mm-hmm. And then people were saying, Alicia Keys was coming on. And I love Alicia Keys. Mm-hmm. But at that point, we're like, we don't care. We want to march at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And so what everybody was seeing at home, we didn't actually see.
Right. You had to get in front of a screen if you wanted to mm-hmm. hear anything. Mm-hmm. And it was tough to get in front of a screen, but we kind of wedged our way in, made people mad, our way in.
And we protected each other, too.
But
we made medical circles
mm-hmm.
whenever, because people were fainting. And we made medical circles. We would scream, you know, mm-hmm. everybody in the entire crowd would point in one direction to get the ambulance over there.
And you chant, medic, medic.
Medic, medic. And mm-hmm. we got people out pretty fast. It was very, very collaborative, the entire thing. We mm-hmm. knew that some people would be we knew that some people needed to be taken a little bit better care of, and some people were not prepared coming in, so we would share things. We would share food, we would share water. Because you thought you would be able to get out, but once you got sucked in,
you couldn't
get out.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So we had, from my son's labor union newspaper, there were, mm-hmm. I think, 12 auto workers, women auto workers. Why do you think it's important for labor unions to get involved with issues like this?
Because you need to be represented. Mm-hmm. If the big business decides that you're obsolete and you're just going to be on the assembly line, the decades of work that people have struggled through and died for is just going to go down the drain. You can agree to disagree with unions on certain things. That's okay. But people don't understand what right to work means a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. It means that, guess what? We're going to decide if you get overtime. We're going to decide what days you work. We're going to decide these things. You're not going to. You're not going to decide these things. You're a woman. You're Muslim and you need to pray. You are a Hispanic and you don't speak fluent English. Guess what? You're not going to be protected and you're fired. So there needs to be protections. Unions were not just set up because it was cute. Unions were set up because businesses will take advantage of their workers if they are not kept in line by the masses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what unions are there for.
Yeah. They fight. They fight for you.
They fight for you. And again, we can agree to disagree and tweak things and work things out. Mm-hmm. But when I found out that unions actually voted against themselves, it was disappointing. I don't think they realized how much that they're about to lose in the next, well, they're losing now.
Yeah,
well, that's a whole other show.
Yeah.
That again. But what did you learn from attending this march?
I learned how big the scope was, how desperate people were to be heard, to connect, and to know what to do, like where to go, who they should contact. I think it was great that they had so many different types of people represented, from the Black Lives Matter movement to Muslims, to immigration, reproductive rights. I mean, I think it gave you a really good sense, the LGBTQ community, of where you could fight. Where did you want to go? Mm-hmm. I think it was really big and nice and kind of a, I don't want to say family, but like a nice little...
It was a kumbaya moment.
Yeah, a nice little union coming together.
So that now from this, what advice can you give people who want to continue going forward, even when it looks bleak, when it looks sad?
You need to get your calendar out. You need to write down every single day in which you're going to be calling your representatives. You need to find out who your representatives are. You need to get online. You need to get them those numbers. Put them in your phones. Do not let them be deleted. You need to be on certain websites. You can be on ours, which is Everything is Possible. You can be on, if you're more concerned with Planned Parenthood, if you're more concerned with the environment, go to Sierra Club. Find something that you are passionate about and do not stop. You need to call. You need to fax. You need to show up. Don't get overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. One topic at a time is fine. Find people that are leading and follow their efforts. You need to show up. You have to call. You have to fax. You cannot just go into your homes and go back into your bubble. Get out of the bubble and stick together. We are stronger together. We have to stick together. This is going to be a long journey. It's not going to be pretty, but we're going to do this together.
Katie, yeah. You have anything to add?
I would second what Britton say is, you know, it's going to be a tough fight. Try not to get overwhelmed. You know, obviously everybody has a limit of what they can offer, but volunteer. Get out there in your neighborhood. Find groups that are specific to where you live if you want to know what's going on in your community. And then, again, fight.
Okay. Okay, well, there is a long history of protests in this country, again, from the Boston Tea Party to the Civil Rights Movement. It's just part of our heritage to make government better and more just. As the chant says, this is what democracy looks like. January 21st, Women's March truly showed what democracy looked like. Thanks to our guests, Katie and Britton, who made the journey to D.C. and above that, organized for other people to go. Over 600 Missourians went. And thank you for listening. Thank you for coming.
Thank you,
Chris, for having us.
I believe in this moment we can make our tomorrows. I believe in the girls who came before us, who made history. I believe in dreams, hard work and equality. I believe I can be anything I dare to be. You were a mother to all that armies. Oh, you sat on a bus, flew across the world and back again. You did this all for us.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams from the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I wanted to talk a little bit about your rights, specifically in terms of when you encounter the police, specifically for immigrants, with all the news that we've had recently about raids, about individuals being arrested by ICE, and specifically what happens if there is a raid in the workplace. First of all, to be honest, your rights aren't much different, and what you should do is not much different than whether you're a encounter the police. The number one thing that you need to remember is that ICE is a law enforcement agency. They are looking to either arrest you for deportation or arrest you for some sort of criminal activity related to whatever is happening at the workplace. In the event that your workplace gets raided, the first thing that you need to remember is do not run. It's going to cause you to get hurt. It's going to cause you to get tackled. It's going to cause there to be entirely a lot more problems than you need. You need to remain calm. After that, you need to remember to maintain your most important right ever when you are encountered with any law enforcement agent, and that is your right to remain silent. If you only remember one thing that I ever say, it is use your right to remain silent. And by that I mean keep your mouth shut. It means do not answer questions. You can answer like your name, and that's pretty much it. Do not answer questions. You say, I do not want to answer any questions without talking to my lawyer. Period. That's it. Do not answer any further questions. Any other questions may jeopardize any type of case in front of you, even if they seem like an innocuous question. You may want to also invoke your right to have your consulate notified, and that is a right that any foreign national has under the Vienna Convention. And you don't have to remember the Vienna Convention. It's Article 36 for any law nerds out there like me. But all you have to say is, I want to invoke my right to have my consulate notified of my detention. Please notify the Mexican consulate or the Honduran consulate or whatever consulate it is related to your country. That way they will need to let your consulate know that you have been detained. Other than that, do not answer any questions, period. That is the most important thing. If you are a person who is witnessing an immigrant being arrested, there are some things that you should know. Number one, do not try to interfere. This can also cause you to get arrested or hurt. You could, however, take pictures or video, particularly if you're in a public space. Now, many agents or officers do not like to be videoed or recorded or having their pictures taken. But as long as you're in a public space and you're not in a space that prohibits video, like, for example, if you're inside a courtroom, most courtrooms don't allow video, and so you probably wouldn't be allowed to take a video or picture inside, for example, a courtroom. But as long as you are in a public space, you should be able to video. There are a number of different apps, like, for example, the ACLU has an app where you can video or take pictures and then turn it off, and it automatically uploads to a cloud where the video is then saved. These types of things are very important, particularly for lawyers and activists who are trying to get a handle on a lot of rumors that are flying around in terms of where arrests are being taken place, where raids are being taken place. So these types of firsthand confirmed videos and information are very helpful. Other than that, let me stress again, do not answer any questions. Ask for a lawyer. Ask to call a family member so they can call a lawyer for you. If you don't have a lawyer, now might be a good time to go ahead and touch base with one so that you can be planning some safety plans. My website is www.williamslawkc.com. I have posted on there some safety planning tips that you can check out. That's all the time we have for tonight. I'm sure I'll be talking about this much more. This is Angie Williams from the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams. Please stay safe and stay silent.
Thanks, Angie. And just one question, because I've been told that immigrants who get arrested should not say what country they're from. But you said if you ask for your consulate, then they will know what country you're from.
That's true, and that's a matter of some debate in terms of, like, strategy for some lawyers. Some lawyers would prefer you not say anything at all. I feel like that notifying your consulate is one way to get the detention process recognized. It's also something that can allow us, particularly here in Kansas City, for those who are Mexican nationals, to be able to touch base with the Mexican consulate to find out issues related to detention. Uh-huh. That's not all lawyers will agree with me on that. It's my feeling that people ought to use their right related to the Vienna Convention and have their consulate notified.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
All right, now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. It's short but important. Saturday, the Wyandotte County Democratic Breakfast will be at 8:15 a.m. for breakfast, 9:15 for the talk, and the talk is by Mayor Mark Holland. That's at the Dot Spot, 8123 Parallel Parkway, Kansas City, Kansas. If you want to come for breakfast, you need to make a reservation. And, call the Dot Spot. Worker Justice Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft, Monday, February 20th, 5 to 8 p.m. at El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. They've been getting lots of cases of people who are victims of wage theft, and they need volunteers. So if you want to help out, please show up. Monday. Yeah, it's a great clinic. Monday, 5 to 8 p.m., El Centro. And then Town Hall, Save Our Care. This is about the Affordable Care Act. And they'll be taking testimonies and talking to public officials about why we need to save the Affordable Care Act. Saturday, February 25th, 1 to 2:30 p.m. at the Teamsters Union, 4501 Emanuel Cleaver 2 Boulevard. And that's sponsored by Kansas City Jobs with Justice. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is about two books. One's called Gunpowder Girls of the Civil War. It's kind of explosive. And also, Fanny Never Flinched, about labor heroine Fanny Sellens. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.